Ogara, and it's installed solar panels at 2 youth community centers, so people can now use the spaces to access the internet and charge their phones. When he goes back to visit, Umahoza says he's happy to see people gathered in the centers.
Like at nighttime, students, they are reading. Others, they just come to access Wi-Fi to just sit around and talk.
So solar energy is helping improve the lives of people living at Tangogara. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are now tuned into CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC. Want to know more about the channel? Find us online at cjsf.ca.
Last week on Wings, you heard a discussion among women workers in development and relief agencies about women's difficulty reporting sexual abuse and getting effective action. This week, we revisit excerpts from a keynote address by a world-famous scholar of deconstructionism who takes as her theme the question from her best-known essay, Can the Subaltern Speak? The related question embedded in the talk is, if she speaks, can she be properly understood? When the listeners superimpose their own context, language, and expectations on the messages of those they see as lowly.
The question, can subaltern resistance be heard, does indeed relate to the gender program of the transnational agencies.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak is a professor of English with the arcane specialty of deconstructionism. She teaches at Columbia University, but she also runs schools for basic literacy in her native India. She is perhaps most famous for one rhetorical question, Can the subaltern speak? In June 1999, Spivak addressed the U.S. National Women's Studies Association. Her title was Feminism Without Frontiers, Gayatri Chakravorty Spivak.
Speaking in English to a largely academic audience, I have difficulty making myself clear. I do not defend the fact that I'm often turgid. I try, but I fail. There might be some question among you as to why I should speak for the world's oppressed, or why the NWSA should involve itself in international affairs. Last week, a group of South Asian women met at the Indian Consulate in New York to discuss the integration of more South Asian material in women's studies nationwide. My mother, Shibani Chakravorty, a considerable feminist activist since the 1940s, mid-40s is about as far as my memory goes, so what mother was doing before that? Well, a considerable feminist activist since the 1940s, now 85 and frail, was visiting me in New York. When our discussion was well underway, Shashi Tripathi turned to my mother and asked for advice. Mother surprised us all by saying, don't just concentrate on South Asia, think of other people. This was a bombshell in that meeting of engaged identitarians, this old lady, you know, speaking English with an accent. Why is she saying this? The idea of speaking for the relevant identity group by natural election, as it were, is based upon the notion of claiming rights. This was certainly important in the national liberation struggle in India, which gave my mother her first notions of women's rights. But now, she was speaking of an older notion of responsibility where others' rights are remembered as part of the big picture. Unless the two are combined, large-scale gender justice is far from assured, and questions of rights are used as blackmail. In the Declaration of Mexico, 1975, the United States, through the United Nations, took on a major role in inserting the world's women into a new economic order, and I quote the Declaration. True peace cannot be achieved unless women share with men the responsibility for establishing a new international economic order. fighting words, but when it came into practice, indeed, the new economic order was not an unmixed blessing for the world's women. Since the end of the Cold War, this involvement has increased greatly. Whatever I say this evening relates to the responsibilities, remembering my mother now, of a feminism without frontiers that is already in place. In her essay in the National Women's Studies Association Journal, Challenging Imperialism in International Women's Organizations, Leila Rapp shows that discussions in the 1970s and 1980s about what was or was not a feminist issue tended to pit first world against third world women and can be seen as a continuation of the dialogue prompted by the first querying of imperialism within the international women's movement earlier in the century. But one of the main issues in today's globalizing world is the idea that there is a West against the rest, that we are against white women. That is an absurdly outdated idea. There are, in fact, to quote such an impeccable non-feminist source as the former Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, there is today under electronic capitalism all over the world a secessionist class of managerial persons who belong to all kinds of colors and all kinds of races and all kinds of nations who are the forces against whom we fight. V. Eugene Baribeau writes how the economic restructuring programs instituted by the forces of globalization work against the interests of Caribbean women in particular. She, and I quote, proposes a postmodern feminist approach that puts the household in place of the market as the core unit of economic analysis, end of quote. Welcoming her powerful contribution, I would like to go on to suggest that this gap between economic restructuring and women is more general than the Caribbean, and that the solutions might involve more than including the households. And finally, from this issue of the NWSA Journal, Diane Engber's essay endorses the imagination as our inbuilt instrument of othering. I quote, anyone seeking to understand cultures remote from her own must engage her imagination. White scholars and teachers must take responsibility by rephrasing Spivak's rhetorical question. She understands that it is a rhetorical question. Can the subaltern speak to, I continue with the quote, how can we as Western readers learn to hear the subaltern speak? This is, of course, what I meant. Thank you, Diane Engber. It is not that the subaltern, without access to lines of mobility, does not speak. It is that, without institutional validation, she cannot be heard. My example in the essay to which Engber refers is a woman who was not heard by women of her own culture. Impatient readers have always thought that that essay is about colonialism. No. I also fought there the institutional validation by classical Hinduism. Classical Hinduism gives a certain kind of agency to women. The colonizers come in and put in a reform, another kind of free choice to women. When a single woman acts alone without these validating agencies, women of her own kind cannot hear her. It's about building infrastructures. That's what that essay is about. So the suicide in Can the Subaltern Speak? It was a puzzle since, as Bhuvaneshwari was menstruating at the time, it was clearly not a case of illicit pregnancy. When I wrote the story, my mother asked me, you're actually going to use her name, because of course a family person. And I said to her, I said, Ma, you'll notice nobody will take any notice of what she was called, and indeed this is true. So the suicide was a puzzle since, as Bhuvaneshwari was menstruating at the time, it was clearly not a case of illicit pregnancy. Nearly a decade later, it was discovered in a letter she had left for her elder sister that she was a member of one of the many groups involved in the armed struggle for Indian independence. She had been entrusted with a political assassination. Unable to confront the task and yet aware of the practical need for trust, she had killed herself. Bhuvaneshwari had known that her death would be diagnosed as the outcome of illegitimate passion. She had therefore waited for the onset of menstruation. While waiting, Bhuvaneshwari, who was no doubt looking forward to good wifehood, perhaps rewrote the social text of sati suicide, that is to say, self-immolation of widows, in an interventionist way. She generalized the sanctioned motive for female suicide by taking immense trouble to displace, not merely deny, in the physiological inscription of her body, its imprisonment within legitimate passion by a single male. In the immediate context, her act became absurd, a case of delirium rather than sanity. But the displacing gesture, waiting for menstruation, is a reversal of the prohibition against a menstruating widow's right to immolate herself. That's the religious agency. The unclean widow must wait publicly until the cleansing bath of the fourth day, when she is no longer menstruating, in order to claim her dubious privilege. In my reading, Bhuvaneshwari Bhaduri's suicide is an unemphatic, ad hoc, subaltern rewriting of the social text of sati suicide. I know of Bhuvaneshwari's life and death through family connections, through the discourse of the male leaders and participants in the independence movement. The subaltern as female cannot be heard or read. Before investigating thoroughly, I asked her nieces, and the response was, "It appears that it was a case of illicit love." I wrote in anguish, "The subaltern cannot speak," and at least Diane Engbar realizes that this was a rhetorical question: can the subaltern speak? The question then is, what particular infrastructures did this woman, Bhuvaneshwari Bhaduri, need so that the desperate speech act of her body could be completed? This is a dramatic example that took place more than 70 years ago. In today's more sober collective context, the question, can subaltern resistance be heard, does indeed relate to the lack of fit between economic restructuring and the shift from women in development to gender and development as the gender program of the transnational agencies, in particular the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, otherwise known as the World Bank. The goal of economic restructuring is to establish the same system of exchange all over the world. In my country, for example, that managerial class is called DIPSOs, dollar income private sector. In other words, living in India, but in fact dollar income belonging to that secessionist community. A kind of frozen idea of national identity will no longer work. And given unequal development, you can imagine that this is much more dire for certain countries than for others. And so as these barriers are removed, the role of the state becomes less and less, even if, giving it the benefit of the doubt, even if it wanted to engage in social redistribution. The idea of constitutional redress, in fact, becomes less and less possible. So in fact, the World Trade Organization is the unspoken government of the world. And it just seems to me that the thing that's really breaking feminism without frontiers, a kind of sanctioned ignorance. And you will notice all of these kinds of organizations, like Women Against Violence, all sorts of organizations, are given from US sources, you know, by the human rights section of this organization or that in the United States, some kind of push toward micro-enterprise. So from that point of view, since a lot of, quote, development involves pharmaceutical dumping, it is in the interest of economic restructuring to reduce women to their reproductive apparatus, and therefore primary health care of the whole body disappears. You know, I tell you, at the ICPD, the International Conference on Population and Development, once that paragraph was solidified about reproductive rights, those of us who stood up and spoke about this kind of restructuring and then the issues of development were silenced as consensus breakers.
On Wings, you're listening to excerpts from a keynote address to the U.S. National Women's Studies Association by Columbia University Humanities Professor Gayatri Spivak. She is well known as a deconstructionist, and for her essay, "Can the Subaltern Speak?" Spivak wrote about that essay, quote, "It was an engagement with that part of deconstruction which looked at what is excluded when we construct systems."
Now, to quote Nicole Armatroyd of Women's World Banking, micro-enterprise without any kind of infrastructural involvement is to open a huge untapped sector to the commercial market. It was with this in mind that I responded to an invitation from the Gender and Law Division of the World Bank. God knows The only reason why they asked me was so that they could put in their reports that they had actually asked me. But nonetheless, you know, I try to sort of go and kick butt wherever I'm asked these kinds of things. So, you know, I went. I gave them a general warning that nothing I said would be of any use unless we could have a general discussion leading to policy change about the relationship between economic restructuring on the one hand and gender and development on the other. I then proceeded to talk about the kind of intervention the World Bank field worker is obliged to make. Before I quote from their internal memo, which actually I got 16th hand because someone leaked it to the activist's email information, so I can actually quote them quoting me because I got it that way. Okay. So before I quote from their internal memo, let me request the NWSA, whose mission statement includes collective action among women, to get behind mobilizing such policy discussions. Because if a single Gayatri Spivak goes and then talks about the imagination to the World Bankers, it must have seemed pitifully impractical. So that is nothing. But on the other hand, if the NWSA gets behind this kind of a thing, then I think it really can do something about feminism without frontiers. So I make this suggestion. Thank you. It is with this impossible proviso in mind that I said the following to the World Bank. And I quote the World Bank memo. She noted that if the goal of development work is indeed people, then one of the hardest lessons to learn is that some of the virtues of human existence will be found at the very bottom of society, which is the target area for change for development organizations. Organizations such as the bank cannot continue to do what it does in the development field because learning from the bottom has to take priority. Learning from the bottom has to take priority. She realized that this position may be impractical or inconvenient for the bank, but I aim to please. She realized that this position may be impractical or inconvenient for the bank, but it was a realistic one. There's much more, but I'm not reading. In conclusion, the practical lessons that Professor Spivak would have for the bank are: sustainable change must come from within. I cannot imagine that I said this idealistic thing, but anyway. Sustainable change must come from within. There goes my reputation as a deconstructor. Work in this area must be approached with humility and respect, avoiding the tendency to, quote, do good with contempt in your heart, and the belief that we are in all respects better than them. Though, not my English, I'm an English teacher. We are in all respects better than them. Those who seek to change must be fully prepared to be changed themselves. The patient learning from below must replace impatient imposition of change from above and outside, and sustainable change takes time. Now, although the general goal of the World Bank is to sustain profit maximization and cost efficiency, and as long as that goal is met, the details remain unimportant. The actual field workers around that table were women of undoubted goodwill. As they enter the normality of rural and subproletarian women everywhere, they are the authorized practitioners of the new feminism without frontiers. Nothing can stop them. In the new global economy, we must learn to negotiate with them rather than demonize against them and or organize for them. You see, again and again, there is a kind of litany that you hear, the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO. But in fact, if one looks at globalization today, what the People's Alliances, the resistance movement, say is that to be against globalization is to be silly. But the only way to do anything with it is constantly to turn it around, strategy-driven rather than crisis-provoked. There has to be informed negotiation. It is for the purpose of such negotiation that I offered them Diane Engber's solution, the solution of the imagination. The use of the trained imagination, effortful and autocritical, supplemented, of course, by detailed knowledge that Feminism Without Frontiers can be supplemented by. My title, Feminism Without Frontiers, is modeled, of course, on Doctors Without Frontiers, who dispense healing all over the world. They're a wonderful group, but they are not involved in the repetitive work of primary health care, which requires changes in the habit of what seems normal living. Why is it better to defecate in these foul-smelling holes encircled rather than under the sun by the water? This is one magic over against another, because no one educates anyone at any length. Doctors Without Frontiers cannot learn all the local languages, dialects, and idioms of the places where they provide help. They use local interpreters. If there is a possibility of a real feminism without frontiers, some of us must now take the role of the real interpreters rather than do identitarianism. Unless there is this other level, there will be no feminism. I pointed out some of the problems that are already visible in the announcement of the draft report from the United Nations Population Fund, which is also there in the platform of action, the Beijing platform of action. You'll notice, if you look at all the details, that actual feminist stuff is mingled in with economic restructuring stuff. It's very scary. I have often pointed out the difference between population control and family planning, the difference between planned empowerment and creating infrastructure for the expression of grassroots critique, and the decline in general health care when states are obliged to emphasize reproductive health alone, and that the partnerships clause may have a relationship with the new paradigm suggested by Women's World Banking to undo the line between elite and grassroots organizations, and that the entire report, beginning with development and ending with financing, carries a brief that must be examined with a vigilance that goes beyond single-issue feminism. But I'm an amateur, a loving activist, and a reader of literature, therefore someone who knows how to train the imagination, which, I repeat, is our inbuilt instrument of othering. Everybody possesses it. You do not need an institutional education for it. In fact, if you don't have, as old Wordsworth knew, alas, not a great feminist he, but if you don't have a lot of external stimulus and you're not that jaded, then in fact you can raise that instrument of real virtuality much more easily than just simply empiricizing virtual reality. But anyway, how can someone who is a teacher of literature supplement benevolent social engineering by women, for women? Many of you must have seen that book published by Oxfam called Gender Training, the Source Book. As you know, these groups, in fact, that are now also engaging in what is called gender training, as they do this, they are really training the world's poor women to be one kind of woman, so that the word woman can become a monocultural word, so that the women can be gender trained into accepting the kind of aid that's coming down. I invite you all to read these gender training books. They are very scary. Let me expand a bit more. Within a certain broadly defined group of the world's women, with a certain and it's not white and colored. It really is not white and of color. It's Anglo-clone all around, secessionist. Within a certain broadly defined group of the world's women, with a certain degree of flexibility in class and politics, the assumptions of a sex gender system, defining female life, children, and or public life, population control and or development, are shared at least as common currency. With this basic prep, and in the domain of gendered intervention, today's United Nations is indeed also frontierless in the field of feminism. So that you have the great collaborative international NGOs who are doing gender training, feminism without frontiers. You have this basic core in the United Nations, which we want to win over in our interest, whereas after the end of the Cold War, it's becoming more and more the political arm of the Bretton Woods organizations. That is feminism without frontiers as we have it today, full of women of goodwill, who in fact have not taken that extra step because it is not really necessary to learn the difference between restructuring and gender and development. Everybody around them says development is good and we've moved from WID to GAD. They don't even really even use the words. So there is, of course, something grand in this effort to bring the world's women under one rule of law, one civil society administered by the women of the internationally divided dominant. Even as we understand the encyclopedic grandeur of this design, we must also see that it is the exact impersonal structural replica of the grand design to bring the world's rural poor under one rule of finance, one global capital run again by the internationally divided dominant. Globalizing capital cannot not establish the same system of exchange on all nations and thus flatten out the struggles of macro and microeconomic history. In more than a structural parallel, in order to establish international women's rights upon the human rights paradigm, the myriad specificities of women's histories must be flattened out to assume a history whose synchrony is something like, synchrony, cross-section at the same time, is something like the UN's six-point platform of action. There is now no other way. You know, I tell you, my student, Alice Weinbaum, she says, Gayatri, I'm working with third world feminists. I say, okay, what are you doing? And I love Alice, and I will tell her, look, I quoted you. And she says, we are making grant monies, like Ford Foundation and so on, available to these groups so that they do a certain kind of research which will create databases. I said, Alice, that's just wonderful, working with these organizations. I'm glad I asked. So now that's the kind of work that makes one feel a little kind of blue, in the, you know. It is the emergence of the general global commensurability in the field of gender. You must be able to measure one woman against another so that all of these from above good-hearted measures, organizing and organizing, never looking at what's actually happening below the NGO level because there's no language learning there. That stuff, you know, is in fact what is going on. This is something that we have to look at without falling into those clichés, because on the other side is the silliness of cultural human rights. That's a very dangerous thing indeed. All the diversity of daily life escapes this, yet it is inescapable. We must accept this because no movement can work without this currency now. We must even suggest that, quote, feminism, as the minimally generalizable common element in varieties of feminist struggles, has always tended toward the emergence of this general equivalent, woman. Marxists in the audience will see where I'm going. Toward this general equivalent, woman, who inhabits and must inhabit databases and even makes finance capital go around on the most rural of levels because, and this is something that you can read in Women's World Banking publicity literature, because their repayment record is good. And they are charged interest below the moneylender, but way above the commercial rate. This is the general equivalent. But we cannot and should not reject this impulse toward generalization, which has something like a relationship with globalization. If we do, and some have the ignorance and or luxury to do so, we will throw away every good of every international initiative. The other side, the side of capital, will not and cannot throw away the power of the move toward the general. Now, I'm going to quote a sentence from Gender Training, the source book, which includes a short sentence with no following under the rubric Ethical Concerns in Gender Transformative Training, all right? One page on ethical concerns, and this one sentence with no follow-up. Language can also be a barrier at this level. End of quote. You're damn right. Language is an extraordinary barrier at this level. So what I was trying to suggest was, those of us who teach at bigger universities, trying to establish writers in residency, for example, in the indigenous languages of the world, so that actually creative writers will teach these little-known languages, and then make this accessible to the smaller schools that are all around the bigger schools, then I think we will do something to undermine this meretricious gender training where language, the absence of language can be a barrier, not really a serious barrier, one sentence is worth.
You just heard excerpts from a one-hour keynote address delivered to the U.S. National Women's Studies Association in 1999 by Professor Gayatri Spivak. Spivak rose to the top of the academic heap in 1976 with the publication of her English translation and critical introduction of Jacques Derrida's seminal work on deconstructionism. She has applied this type of analysis to the feminist, environmental, and anti-colonial movements. In 1998, she co-founded and became co-director of the Center for Comparative Literature and Society at Columbia University. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works include The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. For more information, email wings@wings.org. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.